History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold if we're willing to ask a few questions before it's too late. And more importantly, take that time to listen as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really do find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Speaking of that generation, following the Friends of the National World War II Memorial on social media will always brighten your day. Almost every day, there's a tribute to a special veteran marking a milestone moment. This week, a post celebrating Victor Killingsworth grabbed my attention. It's been more than a decade since I had the privilege of interviewing him in the studios of one of our affiliate radio stations in California, KNZR in Bakersfield. And on Veterans Day, Mr. Killingsworth celebrated birthday number 104. So I thought that might be a good reason to revisit some of his World War II memories today. You can also read about him in a fantastic book Mr. Killingsworth wrote called The Gator Navy, The Amphibious Navy in World War II. Bakersfield, where he lives now, is well known historically for its role in the oil industry, but he was born in another nearby oil town and raised in yet another.
Well, I was born on Armistice Day 1 year after World War I, so my mother felt that that was appropriate and named me Victor as a result of World War I.
You moved from Kalinga to Taft when you were 3 years old, and there have been a lot of stories told about that oil town. In fact, there was a movie made about high school football in Taft. Were you an athlete going to high school there?
I played tennis and basketball a little bit, but I wasn't considered a red-hot athlete.
And then junior college there?
No, I was on the golf team again, and I took part in the Golden Glove boxing.
That's what I read about in here, the Golden Glove boxing. How'd you get started with boxing?
Well, I had a friend that was quite an athlete, did a lot of working out, and he was a boxer. And he said, Vic, why don't you, you're pretty good at that, why don't you try it? So I worked out with him and entered the Golden Gloves at Taft College and got knocked out in the final round. So I got a silver glove, but I didn't get the Golden Glove.
Well, that's a lot better color than most of us have when it comes to our boxing careers. Eventually, you went on to the University of California. And, you know, every veteran that I interview, there's one question that I ask of every single veteran, because everyone seems to remember something. And from reading your book, I know you have a very vivid memory about December 7th, 1941, because it changed a lot of things for you. Tell us where you were and how you found out about what happened out in Hawaii.
Well, I was going to University of California and staying in a dormitory called Oxford Hall. I was studying for finals on Sunday morning, December the 7th. Finals were to start Monday morning, so I got up early and was studying, turned on the radio, and heard the announcement that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was some kind of a joke at first. And then I ran down the hall to my friends who lived in another room in the dorm, and ran in and told them we were at war. Well, they were studying for finals. In fact, the whole dorm was quiet. And they didn't see any humor in my running in and pulling a joke on them like that. So I've turned on the radio, but they threw me out in the hall. I ran back in and turned the radio on again, and they threw me out. After about three trips being thrown out, the radio warmed up. In those days, radios had to warm up. You didn't just turn them on. And the announcement came over the radio that we were at war. And, of course, then they ran up and down the hall and pretty soon it was bedlam in the dorm.
Wow, I can only imagine what that must have felt like and looked like. Did you have to take that final the next day?
No, I called the university the next morning to see whether we were to take finals. And they said, oh, yes, you've got to take finals. You know, Berkeley is not known for being easy. So we did take finals. I don't think it changed many grades because there was so much commotion. But we did have to take them.
And I know this might be a tough one to go back all the way back in your memory and figure what your state of mind would have been, but I'm sure you remember something before that day, because clearly that day changed the world, it changed this country, and it would change your life. But before that happened, here you are in school at the University of California. Did you have an idea of what you were going to do after that and what your life was going to look like, what your career goals might be?
Well, while I was going to Cal, I met a gentleman by the name of Gardner Blackman, who was head of personnel for Associated Oil Company and had their main office in San Francisco. And he had offered me a job in personnel administration and said, when you get through, come and see me. We've got a job for you. Well, it changed all that, as it did for every young man trying to decide what to do. Completely changed our lives, all of us.
You worked in the shipyards there in the Bay Area real briefly for Kaiser there building all those Liberty ships. But you decided there were some other ships that might be in your future. What led to your decision to become a Navy man?
Well, one thing, my vision, I didn't think I'd be a pilot. I had no sense of depth. But I liked the idea of being able to see different parts of the world, and I thought Navy would do that. I did work at the Navy Yard when I graduated from, when I got finished at Cal. And I finished in the summer, about August of 42, I guess it was. And worked for Kaiser Shipyard in building Liberty ships. I figured I could contribute some way by doing that. And then I enlisted. Well, I enlisted in the Navy in February while I was still at Cal. I did enlist then. And they allowed me to finish college. And when I finished, I told them I was ready. And they said, we're not ready. Go find a job. So that's when I worked for Kaiser. And they didn't call me until the end of November. And we were scheduled to leave on December the 3rd from San Francisco.
Can you remember what expectations you might have had, what you thought the Navy was going to be like? I'm sure what it ended up being was a lot different, but what do you think your expectations were?
Well, coming from Taft, a desert town, and the biggest boat I'd ever been in was a rowboat, I don't think I had much expectation. It was just a thing to do. I looked forward to going in the Navy, so it was a pleasure. They took 30 of us from the Bay Area. They took 15 from Cal and 15 from Stanford. And they took 15 from UCLA and 15 from USC in the South. And we traveled by train. The 30 was from Berkeley, from San Francisco, went by one train. The 30 from the Southern California went by another train. But we arrived in Lincoln, Nebraska at the same time. And we all got on the same train. So that the 60 boys from California ended at New York Club University at the same time.
That's a long way from Taft, from the oil fields to the Ivy League, in a hurry there. What were some of those early training exercises or eye-opening things that you experienced?
Well, first of all, we got there in the winter. We arrived late because the train was snowed in Lincoln, Nebraska. So they had a big celebration because we were the anniversary class 1 year after Pearl Harbor. We were supposed to start December 7th. And all the Navy bigwigs from Washington were there. We missed it all because we got there a day late. So they put us all on and together. There was 1,200 midshipmen. The other 900 were mixed up as they came in, they mixed them. But we ended up together on the 12th floor of the dorm there. And so some of the discipline we weren't used to. The weather we weren't used to, especially from California. One of my friends there was from Massachusetts, and he used to tell me, be sure to keep your face covered, your lungs will freeze.
And you fell for that one, huh?
I fell for that one, especially when they would have a fire drill at the middle of the night. We'd have to run down 12 flights of stairs and stand at attention in the cold in our shorts until we were dismissed and run back up 12. They wouldn't let us use the elevator, so we had to run back up 12 flights of stairs.
Sounds like you were ready to move on to a warmer climate, huh?
Yeah, the standing watch was pretty tough in those days, especially if it was outside. Inside wasn't so bad, but outside was pretty rough.
Well, and we've got a lot to talk about overseas because you have very vivid stories in this book from some of the major battles in the Pacific. But there was a very significant event that happened before you ever went overseas. And I don't know if you knew how significant it was going to be at the time. But tell me how your life was changed by one of your next stops stateside before you went overseas.
We were sent from New York, from Columbia University. We were given orders, which we were not to look at till we got away from the university. And my order sent me to Virginia Beach, Virginia, to amphibious training. And probably the most dramatic event was when I was training troops in the landing boats, and we trained on the beach at Chesapeake Bay. And I had big signs, Kaiser signs, at each end of the landing beach. On one side, it said, no personnel beyond this point. On the other side, it said, no naval personnel beyond this point. So I was running landing boats into the beach, and one of my boats veered off and started an erratic trip to the beach. So I followed, finding what's going on. As I got closer, I noticed three girls on a blanket just on the civilian side of the sign. My sailors were trying to chase these crabs, which they have back there, sort of walk sideways. They were trying to get these crabs to go up towards these girls' blanket, and they were screaming and jumping up and down. So I, as their commanding officer, had to get off and tell them to get back on their side of the beach, naturally. So one of the girls asked me what I did in my spare time, and I told her I stayed on the base. She said, don't you ever date? I said, well, there's about a million guys for every girl in it, so there's no point in it. She said, well, Virginia has a couple of sisters up in it. You could get a date. Well, Virginia was Peggy's sister. And she said, my husband's jealous. I'm not going to do anything. So the other girl said, well, I'll take care of that. You give me your phone number. So she did. She called me and told me that she had a date with Margaret. So I called Margaret, and she said she wouldn't go with me unless she brought her girlfriend. I had to bring another guy. So we double dated, and that was the beginning of 68 years of romance.
So let me get this straight. You agreed to the date. You'd never met her, seen her, had no idea what she... You just knew her sister was pretty good looking.
That's right. That's correct. You can go by that.
So then you go to pick her up, and she didn't say, hey, wait a second, this isn't the guy I want to go out with.
No, we got along very, very nicely. We went to the Monticello Hotel and danced in the Starlight Room of the Monticello Hotel. We had a great time. It was a fun time. So for the next 2 or 3 months, I was there about 3 months, we dated.
When you moved on, did you think you were ever going to see her again?
No, I probably didn't think I would see her again, because I figured I probably would not come back to that port again, you know. And I had no idea how long the war would last. So she wrote to me every week, and I was overseas for 28 months. So I have a lot of letters, and we really got to know each other. But I did come back one time for advanced amphibious training. They sent me to Port Pierce, Florida. And when that was over, they had a new amphibious ship coming off of the ways in Portsmouth, Virginia. So they sent us back there, and we dated a couple of times before our ship was ordered out to sea.
And you talk about all this amphibious training, and we've had a lot of guys on the program that had a variety of roles in a lot of those different landing craft. Was this kind of a big adventure for you, getting to understand and learn how to use these different machines and ships?
Yes, it was. I really enjoyed it. It was a lot to learn. Like I say, coming from the deserts of California to the ocean was a big change. But it was fun. When you're young, you adapt quickly. And I met some great guys, and it was a great experience, an adventure.
You remember what it was like to head overseas? Because obviously you joined the Navy. You knew this was coming at some point. When that time actually came, what do you think your outlook was?
Well, I think we were, you know, you're trained up to this, and training is so important. So we were anxious to get started. We were anxious to make a landing, and we were anxious to use the skills that we had been taught. So our ship left Portsmouth, Virginia, and went through the Panama Canal, landed in San Diego. Camp Pendleton is right near San Diego. So we picked up the 4th Marine Division with a flotilla of amphibious ships. and took him to San Clemente, and they practiced the landing there. We brought him back to San Diego and took him back a second time to San Clemente after we worked out a lot of the flaws. And the third time we picked him up, we were gone from the Marines having liberty and partying on Saturday night. The next thing you know, they were landing on the enemy beach.
And out laid on the table here are invasion maps. One of them says top secret, confidential, only in combat area. And this was the first invasion that you were part of, right? This is Kwajalein we're looking at.
Yes, this was the invasion of Kwajalein Atoll. I had a rather unique part in this one. They asked for volunteers to take some Marines in D-1, and I volunteered because I thought it sounded like a great adventure.
What's wrong with you? D-1, this is before everyone's going to hit the island. So basically you're going in with a skeleton crew, knowing there's tons of Japanese and tons of guns on this island, and you're basically tiptoeing your way onto this island and hoping nobody catches you. What possessed you to volunteer for that kind of duty?
I really don't know now looking back on it, but at the time I thought it was a good idea. So I volunteered, and the USS Sumter, which is the ship I was on, it was an APA 52.
So that's a ship from which all of these landing craft launch.
Well, we have a flotilla of ships. But anyway, as we got near Kauai, well, first of all, I should say, the first night after we left San Diego, or maybe it wasn't the first night, the first few nights, we pulled in behind the big island of Hawaii. And this was our first experience with war. Tokyo Rose came on the radio that night and told us we were hiding out on behind the and suggested that we turn around and go back because the Japanese had many body bags waiting for us, that we would not go home, we would not see our wives or our loved ones. And so that was kind of a shocker that she knew where we were at and where we were going.
Where he was going would be no picnic. We'll hear about that when we come back. Victor Killingsworth celebrated birthday number 104 this past week on Veterans Day. More of his memories when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to celebrate with Victor Killingsworth, a World War II Navy veteran who marked his 104th birthday on Veterans Day in Bakersfield, California. More than eight decades ago, he had some pretty close calls in the Pacific.
When we got close to Kwajalein, our team was pulled away from the amphibious forces, got in within a mile or so of the island, and blacked out. We had no lights on at that time as we cruised in. And they put me over the side in my landing boat, and then they put the Marine scouts, it was about, I think, a couple dozen or so Marine scouts, in rubber boats. And it was a horrible night. There was no moon. It was pitch dark. Rain was pouring down, as I recall, and the swells were 8-10 foot high. It was an awful night.
Were you starting to think maybe you shouldn't have volunteered?
Yeah, I was wondering whether we were going to make it, really. I didn't know how those little rubber boats looked like ducks. So anyway, they tied them behind my landing boat, and
is this a LCVP or what?
Yeah, LCVP, and I took a compass bearing on the island, and I towed them in close to the island, and then cut them loose, and they paddled in their rubber boats. My orders were to report the next. I had the radio and was in touch with the fleet, and so it all depended on what I did. We had two landing plans, one to go inside the lagoon, one to go outside. If we had to go outside, we would have had hundreds more casualties, so we wanted to go inside if we could.
So you're scouting out this lagoon to see if you can land there the next day?
Yeah. Well, there's an island called Jacob, which is a short distance from the main islands, and there was a passageway where the bigger ships could go right off Jacob Island. So we took the scouts in and cut them loose, and they paddled in. And then they told me that I was to go in the next morning and find out whether they had taken the island so they'd know which plan A or plan B.
So if they were successful, you guys would have a passageway on this attack that would greatly increase your chances of survival and reducing those casualties.
The only problem is they did not give me orders as to what to do after I cut the Marines loose. So here I am out in the ocean, pitch dark, pouring down rain, heavy swells, wondering what the heck am I going to do for the next 3 or 4 hours.
How many guys did you have on the boat with you?
I had just four men. I had two gunners, a coxswain, and a mechanic. So I told the boys, I said, we got to do this. We can't stay out here in this weather. We'll be swamped. Rain was really coming down hard. So I decided to go inside the lagoon and where it was out of the weather, and we can make it. So we did go inside the Kwajalein Atoll and run up and down. I was concerned about whether we were going to run out of fuel, but we had our tanks full when we started. So we ran up and down inside this Japanese atoll till it was daylight, and then we worked our way back and picked our way through the coral reefs and landed on the beach on the lee side of the Jacob Island, hoping that the Marine colonel who was in charge of the Marines would come out of the brush.
Yeah, that's what struck me, and you tell that story very beautifully in your book, The Gator Navy. I was just imagining myself in your shoes, and that uncertainty, that, I mean, we watch television, we want the cliffhanger, right? Or we watch the end of a basketball game, we want to see if that buzzer beater is going to go in, and to me that seems like the kind of moment where the sun comes up and you're there and you're waiting, is it going to be the Marines or the Japanese, right?
As we pulled into the beach, I had both the gunners had two 30 caliber machine guns trained on the brush, and the other mechanic and the coxswain had carbines. I had my 45 pistol. I don't know what we thought we would do if a group of Japanese came out. But about the time this was happening, we all ran into another problem. There was a sand spit that sort of controlled the entry to this harbor, and there was a Japanese gun emplacement on it. And they apparently had their heads down with all the rain and so on. They weren't sticking their heads up out of that gun emplacement. About the time I saw that, I'm thinking, uh-oh. We're in trouble. You know what's coming from the front. You don't know what's going to happen from the back. But a Marine Corsair fighter plane came over low over the water, and he spotted them, and he took them out with his guns on his plane. So about that time, the Marine colonel came out of the brush waving the Japanese sword over his head. He said, Swabby, called me a Swabby. He said, call the fleet, tell them we got them. I said, how many did you get? He said, we killed about 30, so with knives and bayonets while they were asleep. So we took that that little island of Jacob, and immediately they started bringing in Marine artillery, and the 10th Marine artillery set up on that island, and then they began pounding in Japanese from on the backside of Roy and Namur.
And there were no casualties, right, from your group?
No, the Marines didn't suffer one casualty. And they did it quietly. They didn't want to make any racket or noise because the Japanese could have reinforced the island real quickly from one of the bigger islands. So they had no indication until we started pounding with the artillery from the backside.
And we can look back now and see how successful that operation at Kwajalein was. But what I got from your book was, without that part of it, and you called it Operation Flintlock, I think, right? Operation Flintlock. Without that and what you and those other guys who volunteered for that duty did, the whole battle could have been a lot different, right?
It would have been different. The Marines suffered around 300-400 casualties, and the Japanese suffered 8,000 casualties. So by going in on the backside, it saved a lot of American lives. Yeah.
Well, and the one thing you described there, too, I want our listeners to understand, your life was saved there, too, it sounds like. If that Corsair hadn't swooped down at that right spot, maybe you guys wouldn't have survived?
That's right. It was an Nipentuck. So everything worked out, thankfully. Yeah.
So I guess you're probably a fan of Marine Corps pilots, huh?
I'm a fan of Marines. I have nothing but respect for Marines, especially the fighting Marines. After my part of the landing was over, I went over on the other side of the atoll to an island called Allen. And the Japanese had a radio station and a pier there. And I pulled in there, and my buddy Sid Cohen was there, and we were sitting on the dock. And two things happened there that I think were worth mentioning. One, a landing boat came in. When the fight started, the Polynesian people left, and they started moving down this chain of Fishgut Islands. And so they didn't have any food. They had left their homes. So we sent boats down to pick them up and tell them that we weren't going to kill them. They were okay, and we were going to feed them. So while we were there, one of these boats came in with a family of Polynesian, couple of families of Polynesian people. And it was interesting to see these dirty Marines with beards dig into their K rations and dig out the candy and hand it to the Polynesian kids. They were in the boat. But the Polynesian culture is such that the father eats first, then the mother eats, and what's left over goes to the kids. Just the opposite of our culture, particularly. So when the Polynesian men saw the kids with the candy, they would go over and take it away from them. And you'd see one of these big Marines jump down in the boat and grab him. Of course, they were little people. Grab him by the neck and take the candy away from him and hand back to the kid and point, tell him, no, 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 don't do that. So that was fun to see that difference in our culture. And then the second thing that happened there, a couple of three boats came in full of Marines, and the major got up on the dock, and he said, men, remember what I told you this morning? Take prisoners? He said, abort that. Now I'm telling you, no prisoners. We will take no prisoners. The first one of you guys that brings me a prisoner, I'm going to shoot him. So it was two different things on that dock that were important. But the reason the Marine had said that was because just prior to that, hour before, one of the regiments in his division had tried to take a Japanese pillbox, and the Japanese had gotten up on top of the pillbox with a big white flag and was waving it as saying they wanted to surrender. So he moved the men and the Marines up close to the pillbox in order to take prisoners. And when they got up real close, they set off a charge and blew the thing up and killed a lot of the Marines in this man's regiment. So he was not about to take prisoners. That was the reason for it.
Yeah, and that was not uncommon from what I understand in that part of the world at that time. You know, you mentioned the story about giving the candy to the Polynesian kids, and I saw that emotion welling up in your eyes a little bit as you remembered that. Was that something for you that you knew you were fighting for your country, for the freedom of Americans, but when you saw that, you realized, you know, there are a lot of other people and their freedom that we're fighting for, too?
That's true. And you realize there, I think, first time I thought, well, you know, there's a lot of other cultures in this world other than ours. Being a boy from a small town in the desert of California, it was an awakening for me.
Well, and there would be more awakenings to come because you had some other pretty intense battles, too. And you didn't learn your lesson about volunteering, did you? You kept doing it.
No, I had fun. It was, you know, when you're young, it was a crazy way to have fun, but when you're young, you do foolish thing. And so after that operation was over, we went back to Pearl Harbor to be outfitted and resupplied and get ready for the next operation. And we had a newspaper on the ship. It came out every day. And in the newspaper, they said they needed a volunteer for the next operation. In the meantime, I had been boxing since I'd boxed at Taft College. The chaplain of our ship was a boxer, and he and I'd go down in the hold the ship and box and George Salves. I got to know him very, very well.
Isn't that kind of unwise to box against a chaplain? That sounds like that's pretty dangerous.
Well, he was a nice guy. He didn't seem to mind. So anyway, the captain asked for a volunteer for this job. So I told, and he said, if anybody wants to volunteer, talk to the chaplain. So I told him while we were boxing, I said, I want to volunteer for that job. And he said, Vic, you're crazy. But the captain had gotten real tough on the ship, and we'd had some real bad experiences. And I thought, I need to get off of the ship, do something, get away from this guy.
And the chaplain probably didn't want to lose his boxing buddy,
yeah,
though.
Right. And he told me, he said, Vic, you're crazy. He said, I'm not going to turn your name in for 72 hours, and I want you to change your mind, think about what you're doing. And 72 hours later, I told him, well, turn my name in. I haven't changed my mind. So,
but you didn't know what you were volunteering for.
I didn't at that time, no. Yeah. It wasn't as bad as it sounded.
Well, tell us about it. This was as you guys are getting close to Saipan, right?
Right. We were getting ready for the Saipan operation. And they wanted to set up a boat pool in Saipan that would take care of unloading supplies. Little did we realize how important Saipan and Tinian were at that time. We didn't realize that Tinian was going to be the main base that they were going to drop the atomic bomb from. So we didn't realize what a big deal it was.
In fact, the ship that took the atomic bomb there, you almost ran into in one of these operations. And, you know, that's one of the things that I really appreciated about your book. You didn't say that, but besides your first-person accounts, you took a lot of time to research some of the big picture and get statistics and have quotes from generals and things like that. How'd you pull that off? I'm really impressed with how thorough your research and your explanation was.
Well, I went to the library and tried to get books of that period written by generals and so on. And I picked up some of the information while I was in the islands, too, a lot of it, the different divisions and and people working there. So
you know now how important Saipan and Tinian were and the things that have been said about those actions. But at this point, this is just another island, and you've got a job to do, and you needed to find out what that was.
Well, what happened, they wanted to set up this boat pool that would take care of unloading ships and supplies. So when we left Hawaii, we went to Iniuita Atoll. And I transferred from the Sumter onto an LST. I don't know the name of it now. I wish I did. But on the LST, the colonel was there, and all of the assault waves, the first six waves that land on a beach are assault waves. So the Marines that were in those waves were on that ship. And then I took myself on there and some of the crews that were to land with me. And so the colonel and I went over the landing plan. Now, it's very important in a landing plan that you land exactly where you're supposed to on a beach.
And we'll find out if that's what happened when we come back. If you'd like to learn more about Victor Killingsworth's book or link to a TV interview with him on his 104th birthday this past week, head to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers.
So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, celebrating World War II Navy veteran Victor Killingsworth in honor of his 104th birthday this week. When we left off, we were listening to his memories of the lead-up to the Battle of Saipan in 1944.
So the Air Force took pictures of the Japanese beaches the day before, and they dropped them in the water for us the night before. So we knew as of one day earlier what the Japanese defenses looked like. So the Marine colonel designed the landing so that we made sure that if it was a blockhouse on the beach, that he had a satchel charge or bazookas or something to take it out. And if there's a machine gun nest, that we had bazookas that would take it out. So it's very important that we land the exact spot. So we planned this landing out and the troops that were to take part in each area. And then we rode on the LST from... And we talked to Saipan.
And once you got there, you talk about these assault waves and all these Marines, and earlier you said how much respect you have for the Marines. Did it ever strike you what must be going through their minds and whether they thought they'd be living a week from then?
Well, I think it's the same thing again, Paul. I think it's training, 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 training. When I looked at those young men, 17, 18, 19 years old, they were like, you're going to a football game and they're going to win. They were so excited. But they had lots of guts, too. Yeah.
I guess you were a pretty old man at, what, 23 or so?
Yeah, I was about 23. So I was the old man of the group. We got into Saipan that morning on the LST, worked our way up through the ships. There are hundreds and hundreds of ships. The island was afire, smoking, burning. Our battleships had been pounding for days, our cruisers and destroyers, and then we even had gunships that were firing 20 millimeter shells in close. We pulled in there and put our boats in the water and got ready for the landing operation. And as we were getting ready, the cruiser Indianapolis pulled right in the beach where we were supposed to go in, and I thought, this is a disaster. How are we going to get past the ship? And we had never trained to split the wave and go around them. So I took a chance and signaled for the boys to split the wave and go around. And they did. We went on front and aft of the Annapolis and then came back together in front of it. And she fired over our heads while we were going in. I could see these 8-inch shells, 10-inch, or whatever they were. They're slow. Their velocity is slow. You can actually see them, you know, going in to the beach ahead of us.
I don't think you ever saw any of those in Taft, did you?
No, I didn't see any of those in Taft. And, of course, the Japanese were looking down from the heights of the mountain, and they had already pre-zeroed in a lot of their guns. And so there were shells exploding all around us as we went in. And I remember, I mentioned in the book, a big 12-inch piece of shrapnel going over the top of our boat, going through the air like that. And I lost two boats going in. I had the first wave that went into the beach, and then the other five waves came in behind me. And we always had an officer in the front and an officer in the back of the wave picking up. So my officer that was behind me, his job was to pick any survivors up. But I think one of the most emotional things that I ever experienced was as we were going in, we were almost to the coral reef. I couldn't, in a landing boat, I couldn't go over the coral reef. So I was to make sure they were, the tractors were on site in the right place, and my job was to turn around once I got them there. So as I was turning around, the Japanese hit two of my tractors as they climbed up on the coral reef. But there was a Marine torpedo bomber who was doing something way beyond the call of duty. It wasn't his place. He didn't have to be there. But he flew right down the coral reef right in front of me, and his gunners were strafing the beach. And the gunner in the back stopped long enough. He turned around, and he waved to the troops. And about that time, a Japanese shell hit the plane, flipped over it, flipped on its back, and disappeared into the ocean. And they brought the bodies up a few days later. But just that split second, just as he was waving, he was shot down.
And again, that you just said, that crew didn't need to be there, but they were there to try to support you guys. So it was their lives instead of yours.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, again, it was beyond the call of duty.
All your stories in your book are so vivid. Some of them run together. Was it Saipan where you also described that the Japanese guns were centered in on a spot in the water right next to you?
This is true. After my initial landing, my job was to go back to control boat where my commanding officer was to see if there were further orders. So since I finished, I went back. As I pulled up alongside the boat, he said, Vic, he said, the Marines are already calling for water and more ammunition and medical supplies. Can you take three boats and go in? I said, sure can. So there was a Marine officer on the control boat that was communicating with the Marines. And he said, I'm going too. And he jumped in my boat with me. And so we took off. And the first one, the 27th, I think, was Marine Regiment also was a backup. They weren't supposed to land in the initial landing, but the casualties were so heavy, they had to bring them in. And so they had their Buffalo's tractors. So we found one of those, and I told the guy, I said, we need to go into the beach. I need to use your Buffalo. He said, sir, I can't do that. He said, my ramp is not working right. So I said, okay. So we went on. We found another one. Again, it was an Army Buffalo. He said, my battery's low. And this Marine colonel said, I'm going to kill SOB. And he started getting his gun out of the holster. And I said, no, let's move on. We'll find a Marine. So we found a Marine alligator. And we pulled up alongside. This kid came out of the driver's side all by himself. There was no crew in there except this one kid. Blood was running down his face. Apparently he had been shot across the forehead. And blood was running down his face. And he said, I didn't steal it, sir, said to the Marine officer. I didn't steal it, sir. He said, my guys need help. So he went with us. We found two other Marine alligators, and so we took them out to the supply ship, and we put medical supplies in one, water in one, and ammunition in the other. And we started back in the beach, and we went to a slot in the coral reef, which had never been tested because the Japanese had owned the islands for 30, 40, 50 years, I don't know how long, and they would never let an American on the island, so, and they published nothing. So we had no idea how deep the water was when we went through there. So I went through this reef with these three tractors to a Japanese pier that was about 3 or 4 feet above waterline, and I pulled alongside. I told them that we couldn't go in the beach because the beach was just, the Japanese were dropping artillery on it. Just, it was horrible. I knew every time a shell hit, men were being killed or wounded. It was that bad. So I told them to throw the stuff on the dock, and they did. They started throwing the stuff on the dock, and the Japanese snipers started shooting at us, and the bullets were pinging off of the tractors. So I said, we got to get out of here. So they unloaded, and we started back, and we started back out through the slot. And my commander was sitting in this opening with a long pole, trying to find out how deep it was, to find out what size boats we could pull through there. And I started waving at him, telling him to turn and get the heck out of there. And finally, at the last minute, he finally figured out what I was doing, and he turned around and left. and I had sent the tractor through because they were slower. And then I came in behind them, and I hadn't, I don't think I was 100 yards through that slot until the Japanese artillery, which they had zeroed in on it apparently before, but their communications was terrible. They were terrible. So apparently they just got the word to fire. So when I looked back, the water looked like somebody had taken an egg beater and beat the water. It was just so many shells coming in. It was just foaming. If we'd been in there, we wouldn't have made it. So, but we got through there without any trouble.
So if your commander hadn't moved out of the way and you were still stuck there, you wouldn't be talking to me right now.
That's right. If he had just stayed there and he'd have plugged up the channel because it wasn't very big for us to get through. Yeah.
How many of those close calls like that did you have? Because it seems like there were quite a few.
Oh, I not many, I don't think.
Do you need your toes to count them?
Like I say, I had nothing but respect for the Marines. My job was so much easier than theirs. I thought they were the boys I needed the hats off to.
Thing was, you kept volunteering to do more than just your job, as is evident from reading your book, The Gator Navy. And another thing I read in there with interest, because I've talked to a lot of guys who are on Saipan, a lot of them have discussed how disgusting and disturbing it was to them that so many civilians took their own lives there, jumping off that cliff because they'd been told lies about what Americans might do to them. And in your book, there's a pretty similar story there where you actually came upon some civilians who were contemplating that?
Well, after we moved on the beach, I left the ship and became part of the boat pool that was on the island. My friend Sid Cohen and I decided that we would go visit this commander that we had met on the LST and see if he made it. So we went over to Marine headquarters, and sure enough, he was there. And he said, the Japanese surrendered. He said, getting ready to go up the island. You want to go with us? We said, sure. And he said, what kind of a gun do you got? Well, we had our pistols and our holster. He said, those pea shooters that you're carrying, you need a man's gun. So went over to an area where the Marines had behind the lines, where if a Marine were killed or wounded, they'd pick up his gun and bring it back to this place, and they would cannibalize these guns and put the guns together so that they had spare guns. So he had told this guy, pick out a couple of good guns for these swabbies. And so he gave us a couple of M1s. And so we got in the truck with him and took off, went across the island and then up the other side. And about two-thirds of the way, three-quarters of the way up on the other side, we ran into some Marines. And there was a Marine major there. And so we pulled the truck over, and the colonel wanted to know what was going on. There was a group of Marines in a circle and had a little boy about 10, 12 years old, and they were just talking to him, and the kid was crying, and it was a mess. And the colonel started chewing on the major, what are you doing to this boy? And so we found out that this boy had come up and told the major there were some Japanese who wanted to surrender in a cave down by the water. So he'd sent a patrol down with this boy. When he got down, the Japanese ambushed and killed the whole patrol. So the Marines' buddies were not happy with this boy that had led them in this ambush. But they had some prisoners there, some civilians, and he said, you guys, would you take them with you to the prison camp? So the colonel volunteered us. So Sid and I had to get on the back of the truck with our M1s, and they put the prisoners in this truck, and we took off and went up around the end of the island. It was like a Western, something you'd see out of a Western movie. There were Japanese dead behind rocks, hanging over rocks, behind buildings. Some of them had tied themselves up in palm trees and then been shot out of the palm trees. They were hanging like dolls on the end of a string blowing in the wind. And we went around the end of the island, started down the other side, and all of a sudden we ran into a lot of Japanese civilians again. So the Japanese that we had in the truck started hollering and yelling in Japanese that we couldn't understand what it was. So we pulled over, and all these Japanese started running and jumping in the truck. They were packed in like sardines in there. And that was for where they were jumping off the cliff, right there. They were jumping off this cliff, and to mothers and children holding hands and jumping in the water or killing themselves. they've been told that the Marines would kill them all, rape the women, and kill it. So they had no idea. So, but the Japanese in the truck that we had apparently saved lives by telling them we were okay. Don't jump. I know what they were saying. But anyway, when we pulled in, they all just swarmed into the truck. So we took all we could, and little did we know that that was the place where they were jumping in, the publicity we'd get in later years. But as we started on down the road, we finally came to a Marine roadblock. And the Marine came out, held his head up, and he came up to Colonel. He says, where in the so-and-so did you come from? And the Colonel says, we came around the island. He said, don't you know that Japanese haven't surrendered yet? He said, well, I'd been told they'd surrendered. He says, no, they haven't surrendered yet. So we went behind the Jap lines all the way through them. I think the only thing that saved us the fact we had those Japanese civilians on the truck, and they were amazed at what are these guys doing here? Nobody ever fired a shot at us. So finally, well, it was about 4 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, we got the official notice that the Japanese had surrendered.
So you didn't know you were saving their lives, and they didn't know they were saving your lives.
That's right. It was a mutual thing.
And more than 80 years later, he is still making the most of that reprieve in Bakersfield, California. Happy 104th birthday to Victor Killingsworth. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.